Hello, all you positive heads out there. It's so good to be back with all you beautiful reflections of the one source consciousness that creates and animates all things. If you're new to this podcast, of course, we are super happy to have you here, and we just ask that you bring an open mind and heart to your listening experience and to be prepared to explore vantage points that I'm convinced will help shift or solidify your current understanding of the ultimate nature of reality in a way that is extremely empowering. Speaking of exploring powerful perspectives, I'm super excited to announce the release of my very first book, The Golden Key: Modern Alchemy to Unlock Infinite Abundance. If you're ready to alchemize the circumstances in your life so that your abundance expands to an entirely new level in 2021, head over to goldenkey.gift to download the audio or ebook as my gift to you by using the code POSITIVEHEAD. All right, all you positive heads, on this week's Soul Share episode, I'm very excited to have my friend Robert Grant back here with me on the show. Robert was originally on Positive Head about a year and a half ago, episode 1107, if you care to check it out. And as I mentioned back then, he is an accomplished entrepreneur, sculptor, and mathematician who is helping to crack the code on the ultimate nature of reality. And since our original episode together, he has continued to pursue that noble endeavor by releasing a new book called Philomath that explores the geometric unification of science and art through number. And he is also about to release a blockchain-powered cryptocurrency that helps ensure our data sovereignty. Hello, Robert. Welcome back to the show, my friend.
Brandon, how are you?
I'm doing great. You have been a busy man since we last spoke, releasing a book and tackling nothing, no less than data sovereignty, you know, no big deal. It's really exciting, man.
You know, I feel very blessed and grateful for being able to pursue the things that I just love to do. So, you know, it doesn't really feel like work. Don't get me wrong. It's not that I don't get tired from time to time. I do, but I'm just loving every minute of it. So, yeah. But thank you.
Yeah. Well, they say, you know, love what you do and you don't work a day in your life, right? But maybe the truth's in there somewhere. It's a little bit of work.
Yeah, that's right. There's always some, there's definitely some labor that comes along with it, but it's a labor of love.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to throw this out there up front, guys, so if I sound a little different, it's because I'm not in my normal studio. I'm recording this on the road, and funny enough, you know, we live right near each other in Southern California, Robert, and we're both in New York at the moment. So I came out here for a blockchain cryptocurrency convention that I was last minute, you know, given passes to and decided to come. And of course, as synchronicity would have it, you're up to some cool stuff in that space. And we haven't talked a lot about that on the show. So I would love to maybe you give a high level, because some of our listeners, of course, are going to have deep knowledge, and others are like, oh, you know little to nothing. So I would love if you would, you know, we'll skip over the normal backstory stuff and everything. You guys can go back to episode 1107 if you want to hear that, Robert, talk about that. But maybe we could just start there, and you could give, like, you know, high level, why, you know, you're a guy who has done some really cool stuff in the business world and a lot of success there. And, you know, why you've decided to turn your gaze to this space and why it's, you know, something that you're so excited to get involved with and all the implications that it has, of course.
Absolutely. You know, it all started, I guess, when I was just trying to solve a prime number pattern. And in 2018, after I went to the Great Pyramid, which incidentally, by the way, interestingly, you said our last episode that we did together was 1107. I didn't really recognize that, but 1107 is kind of a very special number because—
Of course it is.
It's exactly that. That's the base of the Great Pyramid to the height of the Great Pyramid, the ratio.
No way, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, you know, who knows? Pure coincidence, possibly.
And you've done a lot of work around the pyramid. You know, you probably had no idea at that time, nor did I when we recorded, that that's what episode number you would end up being on.
But no, I really didn't. So, I mean, that's quite funny. But But basically, I went to the Great Pyramid, and a week after I was in the Great Pyramid, and that was the time that I discovered the Alpha and Omega on the rim of the sarcophagus. And now it's kind of become a thing.
I
And
remember that. I remember that.
it's kind of become a real thing. And I'm super excited that I'm going. I went again in 2020, and I'm going again in about 4 weeks.
Oh,
And
wow. Are you
super,
taking a
I'm
group with
hosting.
you?
I am. I'm hosting about 85 people,
Oh, wow.
and then we've got lots and lots of people are going to be joining us on a virtual pass as well. So that's going to be very, very interesting. But we have the Minister of Antiquities, the top guy, the Secretary General, Waziri, who's going to be joining us even and speaking to us. I mean, we've got an incredible, incredible trip lined up, not only in Giza Plateau, but also all the way down the Nile. And
Wow.
I couldn't be more excited about it. But it just made me think about that because it was a week after that I discovered the prime number pattern that allowed me to predict prime numbers infinitely. And my colleague, research colleague, and I, Dr. Talal Guanam, who wrote Philomath along with myself, and we discovered this, and it really changed, our world. It rocked our world pretty rapidly because a lot of people in the cryptography field started thinking, well, maybe this has implications for cryptography because cryptography tends to depend a lot, particularly public key cryptography, on prime numbers. And so when we discovered a new class of numbers called quasi-prime numbers, which are distinguishable from semi-prime numbers, that they're not divisible by the numbers 2 and 3, and their periods always sum to the number 9 in what's called digital root analysis. When we realized this allowed us to predict prime numbers without having to use something that had traditionally been known as the sieve of Eratosthenes, which is how you predict prime numbers and primality testing. So I immediately then thought, well, geez, maybe if there's a geometric pattern, and we found this pattern in Mod 24, and it's the shape of a Templar cross, strangely enough.
Wow.
We found it as a spiral on Mod 24, and Fibonacci numbers repeat every 24 numbers in Mod 9 and digital root analysis as well. So when we found that, we were like, well, maybe if there's a geometric pattern to prime distribution, there must be a geometric pattern for prime factorization. And so we went about finding that, sure enough, there is a geometric pattern for prime factorization that relates the sum and the product of two integers. So you could actually say that what we now learn, that and we're about to publish another paper called the sum product conjecture, that every geometric form can be broken into right triangles, and those right triangles are nothing other than, now get this, a blockchain.
Oh, wow.
A blockchain that you could trace its origin all the way back to, because each right triangle has two parental numbers. And if those two numbers are prime numbers, then the sort of blockchain ends there. They're like back to origin. If they're composite numbers, then you can trace it all the way back to its origin. And you could basically have infinite amount of data stored in one triangle, right? Because we know that the height of that triangle will be the geometric mean, or the product taken to its square root of those two numbers, x and y. And we know that the hypotenuse is x plus y over 2. So nature does something with this. So when we figured this out, and we figured out it does have implications, quite profound implications on prime factorization, we thought, well, we need to come up with a new encryption that is going to be able to be resistant not only to geometric approaches and new attack vectors, but to come up with one that would be resistant also to quantum computers, which quantum computing has been, around already as a concept for a long time,
Right.
but it's always been something that's been off in the distance, right? Far away. Well, now, Cleveland Clinic just took their shipment of a 400 qubit quantum computer, and Harvard has one as well, not 400, they're 250 qubits. But we're not now far away. It's no longer just concept.
Yeah.
They're being used in China, and even for, such very powerful and somewhat esoteric experimentation like teleportation of photons,
Right.
right? Which you may have seen. So in particular in China. So, we wanted to come up with a quantum resistant encryption methodology and to overlay that on top of a blockchain. Now, why? Well, because all the current encryptions that are overlaid, blockchain is not encryption, it's a distributed ledger, right? It's a
Right.
decentralized distributed ledger. But the encryption layer is the public key cryptography on top of you know, AES 256, which is, you know, sometimes referred to as like SHA-3, right? And that's the encryption layer that is used. But that's based on modular factorization, again, of prime exponential values. It's called an elliptic curve. It's similar to a prime factorization. It's just a modularization of that factorization process taken to its powers. And so we decided that every single, after we did a very exhaustive internal review on this, we believe that every single mathematical equation-based encryption will likely be vulnerable to quantum computing.
Great. It'll be cracked or crackable.
Yeah, because if it's a math equation that's something called a discrete logarithm, it means it's a one-way street. It's something that can be done quickly in one direction, like take two numbers and multiply them by each other, right? And then you get a result. Well, it's very difficult to take that number that you have as a product result and find what the two prime factors are the larger that number is, right?
Right.
It's a much, much harder process. And so that's why it's called a one-way street. Well, if you could get away altogether from this whole notion of mathematical equation and discrete logarithm and one-way street functions, then it really takes you into the realm of information theory. And this is what NIST and the other, you know, groups all around the world recognize. There's only one real information theory based encryption that has been, you know, proven a priori because it is based on information theory, not based on math equation, that it is in fact quantum resistant. And it's already recognized as the best encryption and with perfect secrecy in the world. It has certain implications associated with it and challenges that have to be overcome. But that's what we set about doing. We said one time pad is what we want to basically protect our blockchain. And so we went about coming up with a means to make one-time pad practical, because the challenge with one-time pad is that while it's, you know, well known to be the best encryption in the world, it is impractical for many senses because the key has to be so long. So how do you solve the key length being so long, right? So every key, or every character rather, has to be encrypted with a one-time pad. So that means the key for your, you know, transport of data has to be as long as the data you're sending. So if you're sending a, you know, 100 megabyte file, you have to have a 100 megabyte long key. Now, that represents other challenges of storage and transfer and secure storage and transfer. And would you potentially invalidate the proof of full secrecy because of the risks associated with those transfers, right? So we on our team are very, very much focused on irrational numbers. And we figured out that nature has its own compression value, and that maybe there is a way that we could compress these random generated keys using nature's natural compression as well, mathematically. And so, for example, you could take a number like the number two. You know, the number two is, you know, one digit, but actually it represents an infinite amount of digits at its essence. Mm-hmm. It's almost like you could say the spirit of the number two is the square root of the number two, right? And that is a wave. It's an infinite wave. And so that's 1.4142. And it just keeps going on and on and on and on. So what we figured out how to do is to use that natural compression and gradient descent function, so it never kicks out the same number series twice, to meet all the requirements of one-time pad so that we could have a one-time pad backed blockchain that would be the first. Right. And it's practical now because we don't have to have these gigantic long keys. We just send the, you know, the square root, the number that needs to be taken to its square root, and tell them which digit it's starting from. And we adhere to the Kirchhoff principle as well. So that means that everything, you know, Kirchhoff basically would say that you and everybody else needs to know the method you're using. And even knowing that knowledge, they can't figure out how to crack it. Right.
Got it. Yeah.
So this is something that we've been working very hard on, and I'm very excited about it. And I think it's perfectly timed because my goal and vision for this from the very beginning was about data sovereignty. I think that, you know, the world today, we're seeing a continued assault on individual rights and freedoms. Yeah. I think we're seeing it not only from governments, we're also seeing it from big tech. I mean, I saw some really alarming stuff over the last few days happening in Australia. And I used to live in Australia, and I have friends there that are literally saying that they're like, they call themselves, you know, they make it a joke because they've still got their sense of humor intact, thank goodness. But they're like, you know, here I am in Australia, the penal colony, you know. And I remember the first time First time I went to Australia, this guy asked me at the immigration counter. He's like, "Do you have any criminal records, mate?" And I said, "No, is that still compulsory?" He's like,
That's great. Great answer.
So we had a, you know, I had a great time living there, but I'm watching what's happening. It's really sad. And this continued assault on personal rights and freedoms, whether you're Democrat or Republican, I don't care. I'm neither.
Yeah. Yep,
But I
me too.
definitely am libertarian in that I believe that governments exist to protect, you know, they get their powers from the consent of the governed, and that's the collection of individuals. You know, the Bill of Rights is there to protect not the collective, but to collect it, to protect the individual, and in so doing, you protect the collective, right? So we
Right.
often find ourselves falling down this slippery slope when we start saying things, though, this is for the public good. If you haven't ever seen V for Vendetta, you have to see this because
Yeah,
that's
it's incredible.
exactly the story. The same thing with, you know, 1984 and all the Orwellian stuff. I mean, we are living in that now. Truth ministries and all that jazz, right? Censorship, and it's all over the place, like never before. And the reason why it's happening is we have this incredibly polarized society. And what's causing that polarity? We don't even know what's causing the polarity, but I'll tell you, one of the huge contributing factors to that polarity is the fact that we don't control our data. Now you could say, how do you draw the conclusion that the polarity in society has something to do with not controlling your own data? Well, I'll tell you. If you have an Alexa, it's listening to you all the time. It knows what you want to buy. It knows what you like. It knows more about you and your psychographics and your demographics and what you're likely to do predictively than you know about yourself. It could predict your actions better than you. So wait a minute. That means when you go on social media and that information is sold to a third party, that means they can redirect the narrative to you to whatever is going to give you more dopamine.
Yeah.
And whatever you're going to get more dopamine on is going to be all the things that are going to confirm what you already believe. So we go into these echo chambers of conditioning bias. They're called chat rooms, right? And what happens is we just keep getting parroted back to us from everyone else because the counter narrative is pushed away from us because
Right.
that doesn't give us dopamine. When
Yep.
we think we're right, it's like, well, look, everybody thinks like I do. I'm right. I'm right. I'm right. I'm right. So the problem is that there's a whole nother group of people that are going in the exact opposite direction. These echo chambers tend to push us to super polarized thinking, and we
Yep.
no longer exercise the muscle of empathy. We no longer have to listen to the counter narrative. We can just put it out of our minds. And in fact, it's just easier if we just make it go away altogether.
Right.
Well, this is the worst stuff that can happen in society. So I believe that we need to get control of our data. So what's the mechanism to control your data? The mechanism to control your data is encryption and blockchaining it. We all, at some stage, are going to end up having a blockchain of our identities, of everything, and that we will have personal sovereign control over that data. All we've done is created a mechanism on a polka dot substrate for people to be able to rapidly create an NFT that is quantum resistant. And it's their own. We don't house it. We don't keep it. We don't, you know, there'll be a marketplace for it and everything. If they decide they ever want to sell it, then they can. If they don't want to sell their data, they don't ever have to sell their data. It's their own choice. And now you can NFT any kind of digital asset. I see it as a vision also for creators, musicians, people who are filing patents. People that have really been taken advantage of by a representative culture that we've lived in, which is all third party, now we don't need as much of that representation. That's one of the promises of blockchain that I see. You know, about it, it's like blockchain is the first format that allows for a form of governance without more government.
Yeah, right.
Me, that is very exciting because it's about empowerment. And I see this future being super, super interesting. And you know, what's the hottest category right now? It's really crypto. What's the most valuable asset in the world? It's data. And is it really data that's most valuable? Is it more valuable than gold? Well, clearly it is. It's $2.5 trillion market right now, 250 just at the brokerage level. But how could it be when it's infinite because we get more data every day? Well, it's not scarce. Well, what is scarce is the control, and it's not in your hands.
Yeah.
So chaining, encrypting it, you can control it. You can gain control of it, and you can be the one to monetize it if you ever choose to do so. And if you don't, then that's fine too, but you're going to want to protect your own data so that at least I want the right to be able to listen to counter narrative. I don't want to be stuck in an echo chamber of my own conditioning bias. I like the idea of having, you know, a spirited debate and being able to gain and learn empathy. I've learned things from other people.
Yep.
Don't get away from society. And I think that's what's happened with big tech today.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, makes so much sense. And so I'm curious with this, it's Crown Sovereign Token.
CSOV, CSOV.
Okay, that's about to come out, everyone. So if you know this is of interest, obviously you want to check that out. So I'm curious as sort of the details of how it works. So when I think of all my data, it feels like this sort of, you know, thing floating in the ethers, right? You talk about Alexa hearing me, or how would this be packaged into, you know, a token? Could you give me an example of how you see this actually, you know, coming into the world?
It comes at you as an app that allows you to opt in and gather data, and you can bucketize what types of data you want. You can say, I want to collect my demographic data. Yes. Do I want to collect my search history data? Yes. Do I want to collect my health data and, you know, my individual data, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do I want to know my transaction data? Yes. Do I want to package all of that up and contribute it to a larger group of like people, right? Demographic, you know, sort of inferential data. Yes. Do I want to have it be only by myself? Possibly, right?
Yeah.
That there's going to be a striation for data. And the big advantage of this is that because it's opt-in, you can actually delete the profile that today Facebook has a hard time capturing because they have to do it all obsequiously without your knowledge. So that seeing your preferential data, they don't know, right, what you would actually say. Maybe it could be very helpful to you, right, to complete your profile, to have the conscious mind be part of it, not just the subconscious.
Right.
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 So we think that ultimately this data becomes a lot more valuable, and it becomes just like an NFT.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of artwork. It's no different. It's like, this is the original and it's from me.
Yep.
Right. I think that this is the best chance that we have to get away from this data plantation that we've been living and working on.
Mm-hmm.
Realize that we could be data sovereign.
Yeah.
So encrypting it, it doesn't allow anyone. It's like putting a fence around your property. So it's not, by the way, to protect privacy. Privacy is very difficult to protect because there just aren't that many laws that protect it. And governments always want to move towards less and less privacy, not more and more. I mean, there are exceptions to that rule, but it's just like governments rarely get smaller. They always get bigger and bigger, right?
Yeah.
So as you think about this, what this means is that the way you have to look at it, and this is the way we looked at it, is it's about ownership. It's about ownership. And it turns out the laws that protect ownership are extraordinarily strong. It is a human right to own something, right? And be able to put a fence around it to protect it. So we believe, and we came out with our advisory board, was led in this case, you know, this effort was led by Jody Westby, who's a human rights and privacy advocate, as well as an attorney, as well as Brittany Kaiser, who was the whistleblower on the Facebook Cambridge Analytica issue. And we researched this, you know, to a very, very high degree. And we came up with a statement that said, and it became the foundation of our Genesis block on our blockchain, which is that we believe that data is the intangible personal property of the original producer.
Mm-hmm.
For it's protected by the Constitution of the United States, Articles 4 and 5 in the Bill of Rights. Protected by the, you know, human rights for both the United Nations as well as the charters for the European Union.
Mm.
And that's the angle that we've taken. It's about ownership.
Yeah.
An original need to know that they're already creating the most valuable asset in the world today and gaining no value for it. And maybe, just maybe, this could be a sustainable method to actually have a true universal basic income.
Mm. Is this what you were just talking about? Is the Genesis block? What you're referring to is the Data Bill of Rights?
Yes.
Gotcha. And that's something that you just kind of, I haven't had a chance to review that. I saw that you've done that. And is it pretty comprehensive, or is it a basic statement just saying that?
The beauty of it is that the right to own things, mm-hmm. property, is a fundamental human right. So it's already called out, because you can't just have governments do illegal search and seizure. They can't just like take things over from you. There's got to be some justification for it. Even in the United States, when there are issues of national security and eminent domain, the laws have been severely restricted on that. It requires like a supermajority of Congress to be able to claim eminent domain on something. That was something that Bill Clinton put in place right before he left the presidency. So eminent domain is not what it once was. So ownership is a fundamental human right. And what we did is we just said, well, wait a minute, the data you're producing, you made it, is yours.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore it's protected. It's already protected. You own it. That means that Facebook and other companies can't just use contracts of adhesion in a monopolistic way to be able to take your data and monetize it without you knowing, or at least getting some claim to it.
Yeah.
In some way, shape, or form. So it's not, we're saying that nobody else has some sort of legitimate claim to your data. It's just that because maybe you've agreed to something on someone else's platform.
Yeah.
Right. Maybe unknowingly or knowingly. What we're saying is that it needs to be recognized that it is co-owned. You know, think about tenant farmers back in the 19th century Ireland, you know, potato famine. Even the tenant farmers, right, they're tilling the land that was owned by landowners, largely, right, Anglican landowners at that time.
Mm-hmm.
They at least got a percentage of the surplus, right? They at least got a piece of it. Yeah. Whereas here in this digital plantation, this data plantation we're living on, nobody gets anything.
Yeah.
And what we're saying is fundamentally that doesn't fly.
Yeah. Right. And so this Crown Sovereign token is publicly accessible on exchange on the 23rd of September. Is that correct?
No, on the 30th.
On the 30th. Okay. Got it.
Yeah, Bitcoin.com will be the first listing for it, but then there's several after. There's six that we have that are happening. Every 2 weeks, there'll be another exchange that'll be listing it. So Bequant and Chainjelly Pro and Chainjelly and HitBTC, et cetera. So it kind of goes on from there, and I'm sure eventually we'll be on like lots and lots of exchanges.
Yeah, right.
But
right.
We're very excited where it is now, and we think that it's got just tremendous legs for the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree. So it's CSOV is the actual abbreviation.
CSOV is the actual ticker, I guess you'd call it.
Got it.
You know, the thing that is really cool about it, and Nasdaq.com just did an article on us on Sunday, and they're talking about, you know, market shares and what's happening. There's a major shift in market share happening between blockchain platforms right now. Mm-hmm. Particularly NFT platforms. And the reason for the shift that's occurring is because, you know, what everyone really wants is an NFT platform that is well suited, you know, to be able to have concurrent transactions. So what does it mean to have concurrent transactions? It means that you could have multiple people, right, accessing the nodes at the same time, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so that's not something Bitcoin can do. It's not something Ethereum can do. So we did an exhaustive review because we wanted to be able to, you know, probably heard the oft quoted, you know, time statistics on Bitcoin, where something like 2 to 3 transactions per second.
Yep.
Right. You probably heard that also for Ethereum. Well, Polkadot as a platform was already sort of built with this in mind, and it can achieve well over 1,000 transactions in a second. And it does have true concurrence as well. So we decided to take the Polkadot platform, which we really liked, and then modify the encryption layer so that it used this one-time pad for its state transition function. We also use a modified elliptic curve, which no longer depends on prime numbers. And we're very excited about it because this is the first of its kind to do this. You know, the first, I guess, quantum resistant state transition function that's that is backed by one-time pad for NFTs.
Very cool. Very, very cool. So you mentioned, so on the 30th, when this first is publicly available on the first exchange, that it is accompanied with an app where you actually manage. Is that already coming out at that time as well?
Yeah.
Is it available now?
The desktop version of the app is going to be available concurrently with the the launch on the exchange.
Okay.
But the capabilities will continue to be, you know, more and more with time, right? We also have a new compression.
Sure.
There's a new compression. We kind of innovated mathematical compression as well. And we have a compression product that's part of it as well. So you can use your tokens to purchase any of the software services we have so you can build your own chain. It's like build a chain, right? Think of it like that. You get to build your own chain. And each of the characteristics and capabilities will continue to expand as you get onto, you know, first our desktop app, and then in the future, which includes a wallet as well as super encrypted transactions, and then over time you'll be able to add all these other functionalities to continue to build and care and feed your own chain. And that's something that we just are thrilled about, because that's very much in line with our mission. And Bitcoin.com just announced that they're going through a big, branding effort right now, and they're actually changing their name to Free the Markets, Free the World. So FMFW.io. Hmm. And we are the first, they chose us as the first listing after that branding change to go. So that's very exciting for us too, because it's extremely, very much aligned with our mission, vision, and values of where we want to be. You know, we very much believe in personal rights and freedoms, and we think that this is a mechanism that we not only believe is going to have an impact for individuals, but how about potentially allowing society still to have some degree of empathy and not necessarily go down this path of extreme polarity?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd like to be able to have like Thanksgiving dinner at my parents' house without like having a fight. I don't know about you guys.
That would definitely be something to be thankful for.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I was just, here at this conference, I was just hearing Vitalik talk this morning. For those who don't know, he's the founder of Ethereum, sort of the crypto Jesus. And he's talking about it in an interesting way. He was thinking, because there's a lot of people against privacy when it comes to blockchain, right? In some regards, like this making things publicly available, certain things available is what's great about it. And of course, we're talking here on the other side of that coin with when it comes to our own personal data. And he was saying, talking about this very topic, and he said, really, he looks at it as thinking in terms of data hygiene, not privacy as much, because of once your information is out there, and then of course the stuff that you don't want people to know is can be easily hacked if it's on some centralized platform, and that's what you're speaking to here is like, hey, we're this is cleaner, this is like, it is not hackable, it is not breakable, and we have all heard of, oh, sorry, Bank of America got hacked, all your info is out there, oh, the government's servers got hacked, it's all out there. And so I think that was an interesting point that he made, saying, look, this is really about the privacy side of this. It's really about data hygiene and not this negative connotation of privacy in a bad way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's like, I think it's funny that privacy now is becoming a bad thing.
I know.
I'm not making the argument one way or the other on privacy. I'm talking about ownership.
Yeah, right.
To me, it's about ownership and control. You could decide whether or not your privacy is important to you. It may not be.
Sure, right.
It's no different for me than your own blood. You could decide whether or not you want your blood sold, right?
Yep.
Or if you want to just keep it all.
Yeah.
So, to me, that's the better way to go, because you should be the one to decide what's going to be kept private and what's not going to be kept private. And you should be able to have, you know, the right to delineate those buckets as well, you know, and that's why bucketizing, it's important that you could say, I want to monetize, you know, I need some money. I want to monetize my data. That's, you know, my purchase history and my search history and all these things. I want to monetize that information. Okay, great. I can monetize it. I take it to an exchange and sell it.
Yeah.
Right. And, but I don't want to monetize my health data, for example, because I don't want, you know, insurance companies to have access to that health data or whatever. You could choose that. And that's the degree of control. It's instead of saying that, I think it's convenient to say that, you know, that privacy is not that important, right? Or that we all just need to move towards hygiene. I think the better way to go is we all need to move towards having our individual control over our data that we produce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that makes an awful lot of sense. So I'd love to talk a little bit too about your new book. We haven't spoke since it came out. Philomath, the geometric unification of science and art through number. High level, you know, if you could share, I know you go into sort of unifying the scientific disciplines and whatever feels relevant to share about it.
Sure. You know, Philomath, this was another labor of love. I certainly never thought I'd be writing a book on number theory and geometry, but there just got to be so much of this information that people kept asking, okay, you need to write a book, you need to write a book. And it's hard to understand without having the context of putting in a book. And you can't just write a whole bunch of white papers on your mathematical work.
Yeah.
And so we wrote about 10 white papers, and then I was like, geez, they're right. Unless you're having the step-by-step, you know, understanding of how music, math, art, physics, chemistry, biology are all interrelated through this common language of math and number and geometry, then you can kind of get confused because you're kind of coming into it like trying to watch the, you know, some series on Netflix and you're coming in the ninth episode. Right. It's very difficult to like figure it out.
Yep.
So we wrote a book, and Philomath is kind of an interesting name because a lot of people know the term polymath, but I think maybe less people know the term philomath. Philo just means lover. It's just like phi, the golden ratio.
Mm.
And like philosophy. It's the same philo. So lover and philosophia in Greek is lover of wisdom. Sophia is wisdom. Right.
Mm.
Well, in this case, you would think, well, maybe does this mean then lover of mathematics? Well, no, it doesn't actually mean that. It actually means lover of learning. And the reason why mathematics is used in the Greek language is that in ancient times, prior to Aristotle, so in Plato's day, mathematics was considered the concept of all types of learning. Because he believed, and the Greeks at that time believed, that it was the underlying language to all learning. So philomath just means lover of learning. It doesn't mean lover of mathematics. Mm-hmm. It was more narrowly defined. Mathematics was more narrowly defined as the science of quantity by Aristotle, who came after Plato, right? He was kind of a protege. And he more narrowly defined it that way because he was someone who did philo classes in biology. So he did all the, you know, philo types. And you might remember back in like biology classes, there's all these different forms of classifications for flora and fauna. That's the stuff that Aristotle was really known for. He wasn't really a good mathematician. He wasn't known for mathematics. He wasn't really a geometer. So when using the term mathematics, it became a more narrow concept. And what we wanted to teach with this is that philomath is really about a lover of learning. And it's something that we don't stop when we leave school.
Yeah.
And geometry is something we shouldn't stop when we exit the ninth grade or 10th grade. It should be a lifelong pursuit. There's a reason why the great philosophers throughout history were all geometers. And it's because it has this way of demonstrating symmetry and balance in all things. It helps to transcend these concepts of duality and polarity. And that's, I think, why the book has been so popular. I've been stunned to see that it's been out now for 6 months and it's occupied, you know, pretty much the number one sales position on Amazon in number theory and geometry for the last 6 months now.
Wow.
Which is,
congratulations.
I'm astounded by that, you know, but
yeah,
we really took this broad approach to it. So it doesn't feel like a regular math book when you read it. And people ask me all the time, they're like, is this going to be like, I mean, I can't believe the number of people that have gone out to buy this book and that actually do their own little testimonials on it on social media and such, because it's the people that you wouldn't expect that would be buying like what they thought maybe would be a math textbook. It's not at all a math textbook. It's a math philosophy book, but it also introduces math concepts that connect and bind all these disparate disciplines within science and art. You know, Leonardo da Vinci said, to achieve a complete mind, study the science of art. Study the art of science. Learn how to see. Realize that everything is connected. And that is such a profound statement, and one that we tried very hard to embody in the book, so that you could see that the universe is actually working for us and speaking to us all the time. Its primary language is number.
Yeah. So language of the universe. Really, really.
Which it really is. And, you know, when you allow consciousness and the universe to speak to you, then you start realizing the universe isn't just happening to us. It's happening for us.
Right. Yeah. Something we say all the time on this show. And it's really interesting when you look at it through, you know, it's sort of like, you know, you think of consciousness and art and these sorts of esoteric things as the other side of something as, you know, concrete as mathematics. And really by showing how the two are reflections of one another in a certain sense is what you're doing, right?
Right. Absolutely. So it's such a labor of love. It really is. And seeing people get super excited about mathematics has been one of the highlights of my entire career in life.
Yeah.
You know, they're like, they have an entirely new relationship with mathematics. They realize that they actually had a relationship already. It's just, they thought that that relationship was music, or they thought it was art, or they thought it was architecture, or they thought it was some other expression, poetry, all of which have foundations of mathematics.
Yeah.
Right. And form and symmetry and beautiful asymmetry too. So these things are all mathematical principle, even down to how we assess attractiveness.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much mathematical. It's just done at a subconscious level. When you see someone who has a beautiful face,
and you symmetry, right?
Face, you'll find the golden ratio all through that person's face and its ratios.
Yeah.
Right. The distance between the pupil to pupil is one, but the distance from the side of your forehead from temple to temple is 1.618, right? If you're off of that ratio, we find it less attractive, right?
Huh.
And people don't do the math, but we're subconsciously doing the math. When you look at, you know, a woman's figure and you see a waist to hip ratio, that is also related to phi, the golden mean. So it's very much a 1.618. And it's funny because I worked in the beauty business for a long time when I was president of Allergan Medical. And most people often will get their lips injected, right, with like dermal fillers like Juvederm. And that's a product that I had launched when I was at Allergan in my past life.
Right, right.
Even though it was in this lifetime, it feels like a past life now.
Feels like a different you, right?
Oh, yeah, totally different me. But I had to learn that this was sort of like, I thought it's so classic that I'm in this world of like the aesthetics industry, right?
Yeah.
And you know, they would inject their upper lip, but actually a lot of people would get that wrong because it would take and it wouldn't look right, right? It's sort of like someone who looks kind of out of balance when they would inject too much in the upper lip, because the bottom lip needs to have 1.618, the volume of the upper lip.
Wow. Wow.
To meet these ratios, we're all living a mathematical life. We just don't know it. We just say it's beautiful or that's artistic. Or the same thing is true with food. The frequencies that we get off of food, the sound that we're listening to, you know, the note G in music, right? Which is the middle of it's not quite the middle, but close to the middle of the treble clef, right?
Mm-hmm.
That is the exact spot that is referred to, like if you look at ancient, you know, 500, 600, 700 year old musical manuscripts, you'll find that the note G is denoted as the Greek symbol phi. So instead of that, that's how they would market. So why do you think we have a G clef? Because that's the phi. That's the phi note, right? Of the notes in the octave as well. So it's sitting in the fifth position on a C scale, right? On a basic C scale, it's in the fifth position out of eight. If you're looking at only the white keys, if you look at it with the black keys included, right? It also takes the phi position. The piano keyboard itself is phi. What are all the Fibonacci numbers? 5, 8, 13, 21, 34, 55. 55th note is the G note on the piano keyboard. Out of 88 notes on the keyboard, that's because if they had an 89th key, which would be the next Fibonacci number, that would just be the next keyboard of the next meta octaves up. So we're constantly playing and working with mathematics. We just don't recognize it as mathematics because we narrowly define mathematics, not as a language of the universe, but as the science of quantity. And it is so, so much more than that.
Yeah. Yeah. Really, really fascinating stuff when you look at it. I'm curious what your thoughts are on, you know, when you start looking at everything and looking at, you know, how the ratios are so important to beauty, and it really breaks down to math, like you were just talking about. It's like, does that lead you to believe that this is essentially a simulation, that this is a computer program that we're living in?
I need to come up with some quip response to that question. You know, it's like,
I'm sure you've heard it before.
Cause I do get it a lot. I want to say something that's just going to be like, you know, just drop the mic and mind blowing. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe you could, if your face could digitize, expand, digitize, and then come back together, that would be a good answer. Yeah.
Like, you know, look, I would not be the first to say this, but, the more I experience in this world, the more I realize that everything that I judge is what I will continue to attract.
Mm-hmm.
So if I judge lack, I will continue to have lack.
Mm.
If I judge abundance in everyone else and goodwill, I will continue to attract that. We judge everything that we attract, and we attract everything that we judge. It's basically, until we break that cycle,
yeah,
we will always attract everything we judge.
Yeah.
And then one day we finally break the cycle and go the opposite direction. And a series of doing that over and over and over again starts to attract a new reality, a new experience. I firmly believe that this world can either be a heaven or a hell.
Yeah.
It's really down to our perception. So if you look at it in that context, then you have to ask yourself, if reality really is that malleable, is it not potentially then some form of simulation of consciousness? Yeah. And I think that, you know, the ancients have done a very great job of answering that question. There's a reason we have a term Maya, the illusion.
Yeah.
Right? That is another way of saying the simulation.
Yeah.
You know, we are dreamers living in a dream that we ourselves are dreaming.
Yep.
And the good news here is the outcome that's so critically important is to recognize that. And I think that, you know, enlightenment is not realizing that you are God. It's realizing that the entire universe and everyone around you is God.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And you are just part of that.
Yep.
It's not egoic. In fact, it's the opposite of it.
Right.
It's realizing the divine in all things and learning to accept everybody for the way they are.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that is what you're talking about is so powerful. And I've seen it, I've experienced it firsthand myself, sort of this, you know, my own coming to terms with my own realization of being quote unquote the one, you know, you know, I'm not this drop separate from the ocean. The ocean's in the drop, and I am source, you know, experiencing itself. And that becomes a very slippery, spiritual, narcissistic slope if you're not careful. And what you're talking about is really how to balance that out. and so is everyone else. So before you get too full of your ego and, you know, self-importance, from another perspective, you're just, you know, a part of this thing that is bigger than self, you know, chip off the block. And so I think that really helps to bring it back down to earth, so to speak.
Yeah, I really feel strongly about that, is that that's what you realize, is that this world, this experience, you know, if it is a simulation, and I firmly believe it very likely probably is.
I'm with you.
Then what is the purpose? I think the purpose is to just remember who we are. Mm. And with each unfolding, we remember who we are. And in that process, we realize that we realize the divinity both within us and in the entire world around us. If it's a form of some sort of, you know, escape room, right? If we could think of it that way, the object of the escape room, and the only way you ever escape it, is when you finally fall in love with it and perceive it as heaven itself.
Yeah. I love the whatever I judge, I attract realization. It is so important and powerful. What a powerful exit door to the escape room. And, you know, I like to think of it. I talk about this in my book, The Golden Key, and this idea of, okay, if it is a simulation, well, what's the purpose of a simulation in within our world, our simulation? Like, let's say a fighter pilot. Well, they're going to put him on a simulator before they send him into the real deal, the bigger arena where the risk is greater and so forth. So perhaps that's what we're here doing as fragments of the one source consciousness that creates and animates all of this. Okay, this is a simulation where we're getting our chops. So if we steer off track and you know, get it wrong, the stakes are lower. The same way a fighter pilot would be on a simulator before he's put into the bigger arena of real flight.
Right. No, could not agree more. Could not agree more.
So as we sort of wind down here, Robert, what is it, you know, since we last talked, man, you've been up to an awful lot and it's super exciting. Where does it go from here? What is your vision of, you know, how your simulation continues to unfold in the coming future?
You know, it's funny you asked that question. I did this documentary film about, I don't know, 9 months ago or so, and 8 months ago. And also I have a TV show that's coming out on Gaia. I filmed the full first season, and now we're going to film seasons 2 and 3, and it's going to be coming out sometime early next year.
Oh, cool.
And
what's the name of that?
It's called The Codex.
Oh, yeah. I saw you post something about this.
The Codex. And you are the X. You're the code that's meant to be decrypted. We are, each of us, the ultimate encryption. We are the encryption. Who we are and remembering who we are is cracking the encryption. And I feel like, you know, as I look at the world right now, there are a lot of things as we go into this next transition that don't necessarily, it's not the people and it's not the individuals that I think are causing us. We like to make everyone villains, right? We like to say, oh, it's because Donald Trump, or it's because of Joe Biden, or it's because of somebody, right? But maybe it's us. Mm. Maybe the universe around us is really just a reflection of us, because we cannot separate the lens through which we see the world from our reality. We don't see the universe as it is. We see it as we are.
Right.
And so I can't help but think, then how could we reflect or project from the subconscious mind, the collective unconscious? How can we project new systems that serve humanity better, that no longer serve, for example, government, religion, organized religion, economic markets, education, and universities. These are four different sort of collective groups that have become self-appointed arbiters and middlemen for what is and what is not truth. in a way.
Right. Right. Right.
They are the judgers, right, that are providing for society. You know, here's the whatever narrative you should believe in. And I think humanity has come to a point where it's like, okay, I've had enough of the narrative, right? Like today, the amount of antitrust, not trust, but I mean the opposite of trust, distrust, societally for government, for universities, for economic markets, for organized religion, I would say it is at an all-time high right now. You could say anything that the government's saying and people are like, oh yeah, that's the government narrative. Well done. Right. And so for me, as I start thinking about how I want to have an impact here, I certainly don't intend or want to be some form of, you know, leader of some group or something like that. That's not my intention. What I want to be is a catalyst for change in systems that reflect the future that will serve better society, the collective. Mm-hmm. And doing that in a spirit of love and recognizing it's not that there was anything wrong or bad about these things that no longer serve. They've just outlived their time.
Yeah.
It's not bad. There's nothing bad about it, right? It's like the bad, we tend to give bad a bad name.
Right.
Bad. And, you know, the night is darkest just before the dawn.
Yep.
And that's when the brightest light comes forward. We need both. It's the term guru means light emerging from darkness. But if there were no darkness, then we could never experience the paradox of that experience. You know, I think one of the great lessons I needed to learn this life was unconditional love. Mm-hmm. And so one of the challenges that I faced in this life was betrayal, which is very definition of conditional love.
Yep.
We learn through the paradox. We learn through experiencing the opposite of that which we want to learn.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. That's definitely been a part of my journey as well. And that story, what's great for me, Robert, is, you know, that betrayal story, it's one that I shared on this podcast, and it played out in such incredible, unique fashion. We're into the story of redemption in such a synchronistic way. And it's like, it becomes obvious, you know, to me, like, oh, what a setup, you know? It's like, it's a long story, and listeners, you know, have heard it all, but it's just like, it just becomes obvious, like, oh, that was happening for me, not to me. Yes. And I got the opportunity to practice forgiveness and seeing that bigger picture, even in the midst of experiencing the pain that goes along with betrayal. But it does take the sting away in some way when you kind of see through the you know, illusion of the enemy, you know, or bad.
It's nice when you've got an enemy that you can blame.
Yeah.
It's convenient, right? I mean, that's we tell ourselves, it's someone else. But enlightened people that are on the journey towards enlightenment, and everyone's going through their own issues and challenges. But people that are on that journey realize and know that it's a message of empowerment. In the end, the person who is enlightened realizes that it wasn't the world that was against him. It was not that everyone else was conspiring against him. In fact, the only conspiracy was how he was perceiving it. And that's exactly what he chose. It's exactly what he needed. That was his soul contract or her soul contract. That was the challenge that she wanted to learn from.
Yep.
And when you finally get to that stage, then it only teaches empowerment, because people that are enlightened individuals are only empowered. They're never disempowered.
Yeah.
So they're never victims. So people that are woke, claim to be woke, but are preaching victimhood, they're not woke.
Yep. Yeah. Makes me think of this great recording called Spirit Rap. And in it, it's so good. If you guys listening, I played it on the show years ago, but check it out. You can check it out on YouTube, I think, and maybe even Spotify. But search Spirit Rap by Strelius, I think is his name. But he says in it, "I am empowered by everything," and that is such an incredible notion as well. You know,
my favorite poem is the one by William Ernest Henley. You may know it. It was written in 1875. He says, I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. That realization, we are all the masters of our own fate. That's a message of empowerment. I am the captain of my soul.
Yeah.
I think that is, you know, out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. Under the bludgeonings of chance, my head is bloody yet unbowed. Beyond this place of wrath and tears looms but the horror of the shade, and yet the menace of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul.
Ooh, that's beautiful. I have not heard that, but I am grateful to have heard it now. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you very much. Great spending time with you.
Yes, indeed. I do have one final question for you. My cliche closer. My cliche closer, and people can see perhaps if it's shifted since I probably asked you it last time. In 60 seconds or less, what is the meaning of life, according to Robert Edward Grant?
I believe the meaning of life and the purpose that we're all here for is to remember who we are and to live that truth and to recognize that we are so much more than just this flesh, this body. And our world is reflecting all around us. And the most important thing that we can have for ourselves and for others is empathy and love. That's what we're here to learn. We're here to learn unconditional love.
Beautiful. Beautiful, beautiful. I think of one time years ago, there was this website called Chat Roulette, and it would randomly hook you up with people's videos. You could just hit next, like swiping, you know, and it'd be people. And I came to this one, and this guy, he had, it was just like satanic imagery and all this dark music. It was very dramatic, you know, and it just had a question on it. What has no conditions but one condition? And the answer came to me, and you just said it, unconditional love. What has no conditions but one condition? And when I gave him the answer, he takes it all down. He goes, oh, and he's just some normal guy. He goes, oh, thank God someone finally got the answer. I wasn't going to stop until they got it. And it's been hours. So unconditional love indeed. So, Robert, thank you so much for joining. And all of you out there for tuning your beautiful brainwaves and incredible hearts into this episode. Until next time, journey well.
Also, before we sign off, I wanted to remind you to download the Golden Key audio or ebook as my free gift to you at goldenkey.gift using the Golden Key code POSITIVEHEAD. And please, if you enjoy my gift, leave a positive review on Amazon so others can find the book and unlock their lives with the help of the Golden Key as well.